Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Hello and good morning. Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show. Here's my number, 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. Would love to talk to you, and I'm here for you. So if you need some, I don't know, second opinion, some advice, you have a question, whatever it may be, feel free, 888-914-9149. I got a smile on my face because just a little while ago, I saw an email that came in from Sue, who's listening in Milwaukee on our 100.1 FM station. Hello, Sue. And thanks for sending me the email. But this is what made me smile. The subject is, how do I contact Patrick Madrid via email? So, Sue, just FYI, I'm reading your email that came to me. She says, I thought I was listening when I was listening how to direct an email to Patrick Madrid, but I don't seem to be finding it anywhere on your website. Might you please be able to help me with this? Could you please send me Patrick Madrid's email at my address listed below? I would greatly appreciate it. Thank you, Sue. Well, Sue, I can do something even better than that. I can assure you that you've already emailed me. So what you did was you went to the show page, relevantradio.com/Patrick, and there you'll see Connect, which is what you saw. You press Connect, and you can send an email to me. It comes directly to me. And I read it for the first time just a little while ago. So you can always reach me that way. And that goes for anybody. If you want to send me an email, please feel free to do so. I read them all, and I appreciate them all, even if you don't agree with me. Sometimes that happens too, but that's okay. I do read them all. And my word of advice, Cyrus, you know this is true, but my word of advice is the more concise the email, the more likely it is that I'll be able to read it on the air. And so if you really want me to respond to it. Oh, and by the way, that's how I'm able to respond to the emails. There's just so many of them. There are so many of them that it's just not feasible to try to respond by email to all the emails. But yeah, I will do my best.
Some of the emails are pages long, and we want to respect everyone, and we are reading what you're writing, but it's hard to translate that into a couple of sentences for the air. So when you're an email, the shorter, the better.
Concision it's a great word. You don't hear it very, very often. Isn't it interesting how abbreviation is such a long word? Think about that. did I break your brain with that?
You did, yeah. It's rolling around in there.
Joshua sent me a note, and I'm not going to say where Joshua was listening in the U.S. for the sake of his privacy, but he says, Patrick, I am currently married to my wife for 14 years. A month and a half ago, she said she wanted a divorce. I have a 10-year-old daughter and a younger son. We also lost a baby 3 years ago. I do not want a divorce. She is showing signs of mental illness and refuses any type of help. Again, I do not want a divorce. I just do not know what to do. I keep praying and seeing no positive. Please help me. Well, I will certainly do everything I can by way of offering you some suggestions, Joshua. And I realize that you wrote me this email some time ago, so perhaps the circumstances have changed and hopefully have changed for the better. But all other things being equal, my first thought would be, if you think there's reason to suspect maybe some mental illness of whatever sort, if she's willing to get some kind of counseling or therapy or a diagnosis so that somebody can confirm that, that would, to me, be a very important first step. Of course, I don't know whether she's willing to do that. And I don't know what recourse you have. I know that in some cases, and this may not be like that, but in some cases, if the person is really exhibiting traits that suggest they might harm themselves or somebody else due to a mental illness, the state can intervene. And without that person necessarily saying yes to it, the state can say, well, for the welfare of this person, we're going to do, you know, we're going to diagnose this and see if there's anything there. Now, I don't know if this rises to that occasion, but that's what I would suggest. Number one is see what you can do and how you can help her get a diagnosis, or at the very least get into a counseling situation, a therapy situation with a good Catholic therapist. And I can see from your email where you live. I just didn't want to say it out loud for the sake of your own privacy, but you can get in touch with the diocese in which you live and ask in their marriage and family department for a referral for a local Catholic therapist, and they can help you with that. Then I would suggest that if that can begin the process of helping her figure out what's going on with her emotions, then if she's willing, I would recommend a retrovi weekend. And retrovi is a French word. It just means to rediscover, like if you lost something and you found it again. Helpourmarriage.org is the name, is the website. And I'm so glad that they came up with a website like that, as opposed to retrovi, which nobody can spell. Helpourmarriage.org. This is an organization. It's in a way kind of like Marriage Encounter, but in some ways it's not like Marriage Encounter. If you've heard of Marriage Encounter, it's a weekend where couples go away and they're led through a series of exercises of learning how to talk to each other and communicate better. And there's journaling and lots of really good marriage building techniques that take place. And there are team couples and a priest typically, and maybe 20, 30, 40 married couples who are there for this weekend workshop. Well, Retrovi is kind of like that, at least in terms of the structure of it. I've never been on one. I've never been on a Marriage Encounter for that matter, but I know enough about it. And I'm friends with a priest who's very deeply involved with Retrovi. So he's a good man, and he goes off into these events to try to help these couples. What makes Retrovi different is that it's intended for couples who are on the rocks, who hate each other's guts, who are certain that they're going to get married or close to that, and everything looks hopeless to them, and maybe they can't even stand the idea of being in the same room together. It's for those kinds of couples. Now, I know that you don't feel that way toward your wife, but whatever is going on in your marriage, if she's saying she wants a divorce and things look grim and there's really no sign of any hope, I would plug in with Retrovi. You can give them a call. If you go to their website, helpourmarriage.org, they have phone numbers there, English and Spanish. They have a map of the entire country where you can see where Retrovi weekends are taking place. There are other resources there as well. They tell you all about the program and what will happen, so there are no surprises or anything. And they also have testimonials, so you can see how this program has worked in the case of many other, thousands of other couples who were able to salvage their relationship and restore their marriage. Thanks be to God. So check that out. That would be my second bit of advice. The third bit of advice would be with regard to your children, to do whatever you can to try to shield them as much as possible from the ravages of mom and dad going through this kind of thing. It's just deeply wounding. I'm sure you don't need me to tell you that, but I'm just saying it because I've seen this kind of thing happen before, and it's just devastating, especially to the children, because they can't process it. I'm reminded of an anecdote. Who was it that told me this? Might have been Lila Miller. She wrote a book called, Help Me Out, Cyrus. Help me, Cyrus. Help me, Cyrus. What was that book that Lila Miller wrote?
Help me, Google. About, help me, Google. Yeah.
It's about I've recommended the book a billion times on the program. It's a book, the stories of people whose parents got divorced when they were children or even as adults, and they share their reaction as children. I don't know why I'm blanking on this book. I've recommended it before. But I think it was she who told me.
Is it Primal Loss?
Primal Loss, thank you. How did I forget that?
The Now Adult Children of Divorce Speak by Lila Miller.
Mm-hmm. It's harrowing. My parents stayed together, thanks be to God. Nancy's parents stayed together, you know, lifelong, intact, happy marriages. So I never had to go through that myself.
It's pretty rare nowadays.
Yeah, it's becoming more and more rare, it seems. So thanks for retrieving. You just did a retrovi on the name of that book. You rediscovered something I had
misplaced. my 12-year-old just came home from school, and mm-hmm. her friend, their parents are going through a divorce, and the kid's devastated.
And this is what, 12, 13, 14-year-old child?
It's a 12, yeah. Yes. And you were absolutely, they don't know how to process it, and they're going to feel like it's their fault, and what have I done? And mm-hmm. it's hard. And I grew up without, my parents split when I was very young.
Yeah.
It takes a long time to move on and realize it's not your fault.
Yeah, I can't say from experience, but what you're saying reminds me of other things that I've seen. I remember when I was probably about 11 years old, 12 years old, growing up in SoCal, and there was, I think he was a colleague of my father's, I think, worked at the same company. And he was going through a divorce, and he had like a 10-year-old son. The boy was a year or two younger than me. And I remember one, seemed like it was in the summer, and the dad, I guess, had asked my dad if it would be okay if his son hung out with me because he didn't have any friends, and the divorce was really eating him up. So I remember hazily spending time with this kid, and like his father paid for us to go like dirt bike riding and fun stuff like that. So things that my parents couldn't afford. That, I mean, for me, it was like, yeah, heck yeah, I'll help out. I'll pal around with this kid. Sure, if it means hot dogs and Slurpees and dirt bike riding. So I had some fun, but I could see that boy was very lonely. He was craving some kind of happiness in his life. And I couldn't really put two and two together in those days because I was too young to really understand it all. But I look back on it now, and what you're saying, Cyrus, makes me remember that kid. And I wonder if maybe he had to go through that too, thinking that he was at fault somehow because his parents were not together anymore. So back to Layla Miller, the book Primal Loss. It's a book, she edited this, but what you will read is in the first person, the testimonies, if we can call them that, of adults. They're now adults who were children or even older, or in some cases they were adults when their parents got divorced. And it's this unbelievably, what's the right word for it? Jarring series of people expressing their anguish. And it's not something that's going to be uplifting. You're not going to read it and say, oh, I feel a whole lot better about life. But I do believe if you read it, you're going to say, oh, if I was even thinking about getting a divorce, I'm going to shut that off now. Because you'll see the kind of damage that this does to the kids inevitably. Even if they, you know, even if it's a quote unquote friendly divorce, an amicable divorce, things. I remember when I was growing up hearing that, oh, this couple got divorced, but it's a friendly divorce.
It's good for the kids. Now they get two Christmases. How do you respond to that?
I just did. Yeah, I know what you're saying. It's looking at this through rose-colored glasses, so rose-colored that you're not seeing what's really there. So anyway, that was my third bit of advice, would be to get that book. So it was, as part of shielding your kids, get that book. And if you can get your wife to read it, that may really help her, you know, get a different sense of things. Couldn't hurt anyway. And that leads me to this anecdote I was grasping for. And I think it was Layla who told me this. I feel like I'm mispronouncing her first name. I apologize. She said it's like being in an airplane, like a you know, commercial airliner, and you're there in your seat and you're sipping your ginger ale and you're looking out the window and seeing the clouds. And all of a sudden, your mom and dad, who are the pilot and co-pilot up in the cockpit, they come back into the plane where you are wearing parachutes. And they say, hey, kids, we're bailing out. Have a nice day. And then the kids watch their mom and dad with their parachutes bail out of the plane. When I heard that, it helped me to see, or at least to kind of get a sense of just how terrifying and disorienting it would be for a child. So that's why I say, maybe get that book, and who knows, maybe that will help her. 888-914-9149. We will pray for you. And obviously, prayer, of course, is so important in all of this. So that's the best advice. Get the Lord involved. Get Our Lady involved. I'm sure you've done that already. 888-914-9149. This comes in from Cheryl. She's listening in Madison, Wisconsin. And she says, please give me some advice. I have 4 grandchildren, 3 years old, 7 months old, and a 17-year-old who's not baptized. My daughter commented that she would consider baptizing her children for my sake, but not in the Catholic Church. I need your advice if this would be a good thing to encourage. If it is, then I would encourage the parents of the other kids to do the same. I should add that they have no intention of teaching them the faith in the future. I am so troubled that they are not baptized. Do I keep bringing it up or only keep it in prayer and trust Jesus? Thank you. So, Cheryl, thank you. My heart goes out to you. And I can only imagine. I mean, I'm a grandfather and I have 28 grandchildren thus far anyway. Ask me at the end of the show, Cyrus. Maybe there'll be another one on the way. You never know. The Madrids are active people. But I have 28 grandchildren. And thanks be to God, all of them are baptized. So I haven't had to go through that yet. I suppose it's possible in the future, God forbid. But I can imagine and empathize with you as a grandparent how much you want your grandchildren to be baptized, because obviously there's that question mark, that danger of if the child is not baptized, what happens if the child dies before the age of reason? What happens, you know? And that's an open question with regard to the fate of the souls of children who die without baptism. The church encourages us to trust and hope in the mercy of the Lord, but all other things being equal, Jesus said that baptism is necessary for salvation. And of course, baptism is what regenerates the soul. This sacrament, as is true for all the sacraments, is the instrumental cause. God is the efficient cause. He's what causes the grace to come into somebody's soul. But he uses the sacraments, and in this case baptism, as an instrument to accomplish his will, to regenerate the soul, to infuse it with grace, to eradicate the condition of original sin, to obliterate any sins it may have committed. Now, in the case of an infant, that doesn't apply, but for anyone who's older than that, all sins that have been committed immediately wiped out and forgiven. All the effects of sin immediately obliterated. So it's a complete rebirth, as Jesus said in John chapter 3, when he was talking to Nicodemus about the sacrament of baptism. So for that reason, it's very important. And Jesus said it's necessary for salvation. So I understand. That's the first thing. Second thing is, I'm puzzled. You didn't indicate, so I'm not really sure what to think about this, but your daughter is willing to baptize them, but not in the Catholic Church. And that makes me wonder, is she a Protestant now? I mean, is she going to a non-denom church, or is she Lutheran maybe, or what is her circumstance? And I don't know. But if it's a situation like that, then you're faced with an interesting and kind of odd situation, because it's a very good thing for those children to be baptized, even though it may be in a church like that. Here's the problem. If they're baptized, there's only one baptism. As it says in Ephesians, there's one faith, one Lord, one baptism. So there isn't a Lutheran baptism versus a Catholic baptism versus a Baptist baptism. There's just baptism. And it is owned and operated by the Catholic Church. Jesus Christ established the sacrament of baptism within his church, the Catholic Church. But nonetheless, when it is celebrated, when it is administered validly, it has the same effect in the local Lutheran church on the soul of the person being baptized as it would in the Catholic Church. And therein is the rub, because now these children are being baptized, which is the best and most important first step. But if they're not being raised in the faith, they're being deprived of the other sacraments. They would be deprived of the other sacraments of initiation, confirmation, the Holy Eucharist, etc. So it's on one hand, it's a very good thing for them to be baptized, but it creates another problem, because now they're rightfully Catholic, but they're not being raised Catholic. And what a shame that your daughter just refuses to consider doing this. Now, I don't know how close you live with them, but maybe if you're close enough, you could say, well, can I take them to Mass on Sunday? I'd be happy to swing by. We'll come, you know, we'll leave 15 minutes early, come pick up the kids and take them to Mass with us. Would that be okay? And she might say, yeah, that's okay. If you really want to do that, you can do that. It would be an inconvenience to you, but what a holy inconvenience that would be. Think of the merit you would gain in God's eyes for doing everything you could. So those are some thoughts. One thing I would say, though, is don't clandestinely baptize these children. Don't, you know, take them down the hallway where nobody can see and pour water over their heads and baptize them, because even that would be a valid baptism. But then you create another problem altogether, because if it's a clandestine baptism, and I'm sure there are many grandmas all around the country who have done exactly that, and I've heard from some of them before, and I understand. But now you've created another problem in that there's no record of this, first of all. The parents, even though they're making a bad decision, they do have a right to say yes or no for their own children. So we have to respect that. You can always evangelize the children so that when they're old enough to begin making decisions, they may be inclined to receive baptism on their own. But also, because there's no record now, the local parish where there would be a record has no knowledge of this, and that's not good. Because what about when they want to get married or some other, they're going to ask for a baptismal certificate? There won't be one. So those are my thoughts. And continue praying. I'll pray for you and with you as well. I'll be right back. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. Our sponsor, Christendom College, offers our listeners free access to college-style principles classes at getprinciples.com. Sign up for free classes at getprinciples.com.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
Okay. The number again, what? 888-914-9149. You can call me now. We have some lines available right now. Let's go to Patricia in Connecticut. Hi, Patricia.
Hi, Patrick.
Hi there.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, as Peter Gabriel would say, hi there.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Well, I just want to mention my own story very shortly about what you were saying about parents getting divorced.
Yeah.
Well, my parents are Mexican. My father was an alcoholic since I had memory, and he was a really good father. He never hit us. He never said bad words. Actually, bad words were prohibited in my house. But he completely changed when he got drunk. He used to hit my mom once in a while, and we all saw that. That was really, really painful. So my mom tried to fix, you know, the marriage and try to stay with him to see if he could change, and that was for a long time. So when I was 11, my mom made a decision to leave him. It was really painful because I was the closest to him, and I was really upset. I didn't understand at that moment. And after years, I realized that was the best decision my mom made. My parents now, they you know, they get along. In holidays, we get together, and they can have a conversations. My dad does not drink since, I don't know, maybe more than 20 years. So
that's good.
And he's very close to church. He was actually very religious. We used to pray the rosary every day at home. That was really strange because he was a good father, but when he drank, when we used to drink, he got really, really strange.
Yeah.
So I don't say that that getting divorced is a bad thing for all marriages. I think in my case, I understand that it was the best decision that my mom made. And my sister, the oldest in my family, she grew up in a relationship which she had a, you know, fight for her marriage, and she did as well. And she just separated from her husband no more than 5 months ago. She had a really good husband, but he was very violent as well.
Let me just jump in, if I may, Patricia. And first of all, I'm happy to hear that your mom and dad, it very often doesn't work out the way it did for them. So I'm happy to hear that. That's really good. I'd like to just maybe offer clarification. The church does not, and God does not want divorce for married couples. He doesn't want, in fact, the Bible says, God speaking here, saying, I hate divorce. So I realize that there are sometimes it's just intolerable for the wife, let's just say, and she has to get out of there. You know, your father was drunk and he was at least verbally violent and so on. I mean, that's grounds for what the church would refer to as a canonical separation. So in the church's canon law, there's a provision for the one spouse or the other who's being victimized that way to leave, because the spouse, in this case the husband, who's perpetrating this violence in the home has lost his right to conjugal living. And conjugal living extends beyond mere sexual interaction. It's bed and board, living under the same roof, sleeping in the same bed, eating at the same dinner table, sharing a life together as a married couple. When physical violence, for example, sexual violence or molestation, drunkenness, things of that nature, that the church recognizes that there is a time and a place when the wife must leave for her own safety. And it sounds like that's what your mom did. But the church says that's different from getting a divorce. And now, I don't think a lot of people know this. I think a lot of Catholics are not aware of this. So the provision is there for the wife to get to a safe place, live under a different roof. And so I can see why your mom did what she did. So I'm not in any way arguing with you, because I realize these situations sometimes occur. But the church has a way for this to take place that doesn't involve divorce. Now sometimes it does. I mean, and sometimes that's inevitable. In fact, the church's annulment process can only begin after there is a civil divorce. So I realize that this is often what it does lead to. But you raised a very important question here that makes me want to share this with people so that they realize that there is another alternative for safety and freedom from abuse, which every woman deserves. No woman should be victimized at all, children, of course. And it's a way that can help in the long run to preserve a marriage if that's possible. So like in your mom and dad's case, if they had taken that route, they would still have been married. There would not have been a divorce. She would have been separate from your father. He gets his act cleaned up. He returns to his senses, and then they can resume married life again. And they wouldn't have to get remarried or anything like that, because those things would still be present. So I'm glad you shared that with us, Patricia. And it gave us an opportunity to look at a slightly different way to go about doing it. Thank you. Appreciate it very much. We'll go to Bob now in Wilmington, North Carolina. Hi, Bob.
Good morning, yeah. Patrick.
Yes, hello.
Yeah, I was listening yesterday about the woman with the pet in heaven. Mm-hmm. And that raises the bigger question. How do we, as the magisterium and evangelizing other people, how do we jump back and forth from doctrine to scripture and speculative theology? How do we navigate that correctly so people don't just get turned off and say they don't know what they're talking about?
Well, I guess I would try by looking to those who are really adept at doing that, people like St. Augustine, for example, or St. Thomas Aquinas, just to name two. We have roughly, what is it, about 40 or so, maybe a little bit less than that, doctors of the church. I mean, those are men and women who are renowned for their learning and their orthodoxy and their ability to teach really clearly. So I think if we can try to pattern the way you and I do it after those who are known for doing it so well, that's a good start. St. Thomas Aquinas was very systematic, relentlessly logical in his explanation of the faith, and when he was doing apologetics, so for example, his Summa Contra Gentiles, which was in essence really his polemic or his apologetics with Muslims or those who in some other way deny the Trinity and deny the Lordship of Jesus, he He was just really methodical. And he synthesized, I think this is what you're alluding to, Bob. He synthesized with his encyclopedic mind the church fathers and sacred scripture and Hellenistic philosophy that had been purged from error, had been expurgated from things that were not true. And he was able to bring to bear all these different elements all at once. And I would say he would be a paradigm of what you're looking at. So a little bit of Thomistic influence can go a long way. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but Aquinas was incorrect when he talked about the Immaculate Conception, was it? Or something about Mary, I can't remember.
Yeah, well, that's yes and no, I'll put it that way. He was basing his argument on what at the time was the medical knowledge of the day, which turned out to be incorrect, which is what was called ensoulment. And his working knowledge of the biology and physiology of that day was that ensoulment took place 40 days after conception, and that there was a vegetative soul in the conceived unborn person prior to that, and that 40 days after the vegetative soul had grown the fetus to a certain point, then the immortal soul was introduced into the body. Now, that, of course, none of that's true, but he was reasoning from what he understood to be the science there. And yeah, so in that sense, he was incorrect, because we now know, and I suppose many people knew before that, there are different schools of thought, but that conception, or that life, begins at conception. And so there is no interlude of 40 days before which the rational soul enters the unborn body. It takes place at the moment of conception. So the fact that he missed the mark on that issue, even though he was right on target with virtually everything else, isn't really nothing more than a testimony to the fact that he was not infallible. He didn't have that charism of infallibility. So yeah, he got some things wrong, but by comparison to the vast majority of everything he got right on target, you know, it's a wonder that there were really so very few things. And I think that seems to be the main one that people think of, but it in no way undermines or diminishes the credibility of his teaching prowess. In fact, in the Council of Trent in the middle of the 16th century, when the council sessions were opened in the cathedral in Trent, the council fathers placed on the high altar an open copy of the Bible, and next to it an open copy of the Summa Theologiae from St. Thomas Aquinas, to demonstrate that the council was going to adhere strictly to the written word of God and to the perennial teaching of the church as explicated by St. Thomas Aquinas. That's how highly the church has regarded his teaching. So I wouldn't dismiss him simply because he got something wrong on the Immaculate Conception.
Oh, I agree. I definitely agree. Yeah.
Oh, hey, here's a great resource. I love recommending this. Maybe you've seen this before, Bob, but maybe not. The Thomistic Institute, which is an arm of the Dominican Friars of the Eastern Province, they have a YouTube channel called, well, it's called the Thomistic Institute. But they have a series of wonderful videos. They're typically 7-8 minutes long on average, and they're called Aquinas 101. And they're extremely well produced. They walk you through a discrete topic through the eyes of St. Thomas Aquinas. In other words, what would St. Thomas say about sin or virtue, or can animals go to heaven? They have a video on that, all kinds of things. It's really well done. And anybody can begin learning a Thomistic approach to theology and philosophy and scripture. And that's a really great, and it's free. It's a great way to do it. So you might want to check that out, Bob.
Okay, I appreciate it.
Yeah. Well, nice chatting with you. I can't say as always, because I don't know if we've chatted before, but I hope we do again. We'll take a break and we'll come back to your phone calls and emails. I got plenty of those. The number to call is 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. Also, I'm going to share with you, they have a new ranking now, which states in these United States have the highest life longevity, and which states have the lowest lifespan longevity. You might be interested in finding out about that, because you're in one of those states. I'll tell you about that too right after this.
One, two, three, four.
This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and relevantradio.com.
All right, good stuff here on the Patrick Madrid Show, as per usual. Thanks for listening. 888-914-9149. Let me tell you about Lifespan, yours and mine, that is. This is from thehill.com. Here are the states with the longest life expectancy. People in Hawaii, Washington, and Minnesota have the longest. I hope, does that annoy people in Minnesota when people who are not in Minnesota say Minnesota? I guess we'll find out.
I'm going to say no.
They're going to say, oh, he sounds like us.
Oh, he's
okay,
been,
let me take it from the top.
He's been here before.
I've been to Minnesota. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I think one of the things I notice in Minnesota is not only are they so friendly and polite, but they say things like, you want to come with? They say that, don't they? You want to come with?
Yeah.
Trying to think of some other Minnesotan things. That's the one that comes to my mind. Okay, let's get back to this. People in Hawaii, Washington, and Minnesota have the longest life expectancy in the country, according to this new study. A NICE RX study released yesterday found that Hawaii has the longest life expectancy of all 50 states. It's 80.7 years as of 2020. Now, granted, COVID did a number on these numbers, so when they get to the next iteration, probably next year, we will see some changes. The number is about 4 years higher than the national average. So that's in Hawaii. I like saying Hawaii, which dropped for the second year in a row in 2021 to 76.4 years, according to data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. CDC data shows that the difference between life expectancy among men and women also widened. Now, men in the U.S. have an average life expectancy of 73.5 years. That has plummeted. I mean, it wasn't that long ago, a matter of a few years ago, when it was up around 79 or thereabouts, maybe a little bit higher than that. So women are expected to live on average to 79.3. So that's quite a difference. Women 79.3 on average, men 73.5. I don't like that. The CDC attributes the decline in life expectancy to deaths caused by COVID-19, as well as deaths due to unintentional injuries, chronic liver disease, cirrhosis, suicide, and homicide. While Hawaiians can expect to live the longest on average, the state's life expectancy has also decreased in the past few years. So there's more here, but let me give you the top 10 of life expectancy. Hawaii clocks in at 80.7 years. Followed by Washington, the state of Washington, or Washington, if you prefer, 79.2, Minnesota, 79.1, California, 79, Massachusetts, 79, and New Hampshire, 79. I'm irritating half the country right now, Cyrus, with my attempts at pronunciation. Oregon, 78.8
All right,
years.
That's too far. All right, now you've done it.
You don't like the Oregon,
no,
huh?
It's Oregon. Come on.
Yeah, why do people say Oregon anyway?
I don't.
I hear that from time to time.
Yeah, you just said it.
Well, I'm just saying what they say.
Come on, man.
I know. What about Illinois? Do you ever hear people say that?
Come on, man.
I'm just waiting for the next shoe to drop.
I'm waiting for the next state to drop.
Vermont, 78.8.
Oh, see, you didn't make fun of Vermont.
How can you? What? How do you say it differently? Utah, 78.6. They're in number nine. And Connecticut, 78.4.
Come on, man.
You don't believe me. It's right there in black and white. And what's interesting is if you want to see the rest of the 50 states, it's in there too. So you can see where your state ranks. But those are the top 10. And I find that interesting.
I'm a little surprised that California's up there.
Well, California, I mean, being a native Californian and, you know, living most of my life there, I can understand why to a certain extent, and that's because there's so much good weather, for the most part, where you can be outside and there's the beach and there's mountains and hiking and skiing and a lot of stuff to do. An active lifestyle is easy to lead in most of California. And I think that probably has a lot to do with it.
Yeah, and that gels with Hawaii being number one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You might be onto something.
Yeah. Well, so the numbers are there. People can check it out. So that's going to get posted on the show Twitter feed at P Madrid Show. You can also access it on the show page, relevantradio.com/Patrick. Let's go to Heather now in New Mexico. Good morning, Heather.
Good morning.
Yeah.
I am just calling because a little bit ago you were talking about baptism, and somebody had wrote in and, you know, was kind of asking about their grandkids and whatnot. And one thing stuck out to me was that you had said that biblically, you know, in order for salvation, you need to get baptized, which I completely agree with. Mm-hmm. But you had said that it needs to be done in the church, which, yes, the Bible says that. But you went on to say that it had to be done in the Catholic Church. So let me interject here. I was not raised Catholic.
Okay.
I was raised in a non-denominational church. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not trying to be argumentative. I'm just trying for understanding, because obviously I'm listening to Catholic radio. So I'm just trying to understand, because I don't read anywhere in the Bible where it specifically says in the Catholic Church.
Right.
So I'm just trying to, maybe for you to elaborate, maybe explain a little bit.
Yeah, happy to. I'm really glad you asked this question, because I think the first thing I need to do is clear up the misconception. I didn't say that you have to be married in a Catholic church. Baptized. What I said was that, as the Bible says, there's one faith, one Lord, one baptism. So my point was that there's not a Lutheran baptism that's distinct from a Catholic baptism, that's distinct from an Eastern Orthodox baptism, that's distinct from a Baptist baptism. My point is that because it's Jesus working in the sacrament, whenever baptism is administered validly, it has its effects, regardless of where it happens. So if you were baptized in a non-denominational church and the baptism was valid, you enjoyed all the benefits of baptism just as you would have had you been baptized in the Catholic Church. So that's the first part. So it's exactly the opposite of what I think you thought you heard. It's exactly the opposite. You don't have to be baptized in the Catholic Church for it to be a valid baptism. But the point I was making was that Jesus established the Catholic Church, and he endowed the church with the sacraments. He established these sacraments for everybody. And as you may know, in Matthew 28, verses 19 and 20, just before he ascended to heaven, Jesus told these apostles to go into the whole world and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all that I've commanded you. So his final few instructions included baptism, and the Catholic Church says it's like a doorway into the church. When you're baptized, you're entering into the church. And so the premise here is that the Lord did not establish Christianity as such. He didn't establish this kind of like this idea or a system of thought that more or less like-minded people who pretty much agree on things, but not really and not on everything, and they can all sort of share together this idea of loving Jesus. That's not what he established. Rather, he established a church, and he said, go into the whole world, make disciples of all nations. So everybody everywhere, he wants to come into this church. So ideally, if somebody receives the sacrament of baptism, they would receive it in the Catholic Church. But for it to have its power and the effects on the soul, it doesn't matter where they're baptized, if they're in the Catholic Church, not in the Catholic Church. It still has its effects because it's the power of Jesus Christ working in that sacrament through the ministry of the person doing the baptism. So in fact, Heather, I'm happy I can clarify that, because I think what you thought you heard me say turns out to be exactly the opposite of what the Catholic Church teaches. So if you were baptized validly, it had all of its effects wherever you were baptized.
Okay, and then I had one more question as well. And sure. Yes, you definitely explained it. Thank you. But you went on to say that it needed to be documented, and I know things are documented in the Catholic Church, and growing up, you know, for me, we got a certificate and whatnot, but I don't think it's necessarily documented like in the Catholic Church.
Yeah, probably
so
isn't.
So is that...
Yeah, it wouldn't be documented in the Catholic Church.
Is that still valid?
It is. So this is another important thing you're bringing up here. So the documentation, so let's just say that after listening to this program for another year or so, you decide you want to become Catholic. And by the way, we'll welcome you with open arms. We'd love to have you become Catholic. And then you'll be able to receive your other sacraments as well, confirmation, the Holy Eucharist, etc. But let's just say that when that time comes and you decide you want to become Catholic, the church will say, well, have you been baptized? You'll say, yes. Where were you baptized? At that church over there. And if that church over there has a record of your baptism, like when did it take place? And if you know that it was celebrated validly, you know, that the person doing the baptism, the minister, said the words of baptism, I baptize you in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit and baptize you with water. Okay, so all of the things being equal, that would be a valid baptism. So that would be sufficient. So if you wanted to become a Catholic, or let's say you were going to marry a Catholic, I don't know if you're married, but let's say you were to marry a Catholic man, then the church would say, do you have a baptismal certificate? So if that church that you were baptized in had something like that, the Catholic Church would accept that.
So one would have to be baptized with documentation in order to marry a Catholic?
Well, yes, in the sense that if you wanted...
I'm sorry.
I'm sorry, what's that?
That's kind of side note, sorry.
Oh, no problem. Yeah, so yes, the answer would be if you wanted to get married to a Catholic and presuming that you were going to get married in the Catholic Church, have your marriage blessed by the church, yeah, they would request some sort of proof of baptism. Now, in that case, if there is no proof, and let's say that it wasn't in a church setting, it was in somebody's swimming pool, and you don't really remember and there's no record of it, well, there's always the option of getting conditionally baptized so that in case the first baptism wasn't valid, the conditional baptism would provide for that. If the first baptism was valid, then the conditional baptism is just superfluous, but it's a way to make sure either way that you were baptized. That's another option.
Okay. So as far as the documentation goes, sorry, I'm just trying to understand.
Yeah. No, it's okay.
Why
this is an important question.
Like, in the eyes of God, mm-hmm. like in the Bible, I don't see anywhere where it says it has to be documented. What is the point of it being documented? Like,
yeah.
Do you understand what I'm asking?
I do. Yeah, I do. So in the early church, no doubt, the need for it, but the idea of doing that in a documented way, we don't see any evidence of that in the first century or let's say in the book of Acts. But as with any human society, this kind of documentation, we can see this is good and helpful. It's not absolutely necessary, but it's very helpful because down the road, if you want to receive your other sacraments, you have to first have been baptized. Without that sacrament, none of the other sacraments will have any effect. So the church just wants to make sure. So let's say that you went to, you know, let's say you're going to go to grad school and get a master's in whatever. Well, they're going to say, great, come on in. Oh, but send us your transcript so that we know that you passed all of your courses at your undergrad, wherever you went to undergrad. So you could say to them, but I really did go to undergrad and I really did take these classes and I know all the material. And they'd say, yeah, we believe you, but we just need some record that we know that you did your undergrad before you start the MA. It's for reasons like that.
Right.
Or if you want to get your driver's license, you have to furnish, you know, a social security
driver's
card.
If you got it.
Yeah, it's that kind of thing.
Right. Okay.
I'm really glad you called.
Very helpful.
I'm glad. Please keep listening. And I'm always here. If you have any other questions, don't hesitate. I'll be more than happy to walk you through it. And I have a feeling that if you keep listening to Relevant Radio, a lot more of these kinds of issues will become clearer. That's my hope. Thank you. 888-914-9149. I have an email. We're going to come back to phone calls here in a minute. First, however, I have an email here from Mary, who's listening on the Relevant Radio app. Her question is, who are the wise men? She says, I'm an expat living in England, and today we celebrate Epiphany. I was at Mass this morning pondering the wise men, and I have a couple questions. Can you explain what we know about the wise men? Who were they? Where did they come from? Why were they called kings and wise? Also, how long after the birth of Jesus did the wise men visit? Most nativity scenes include the wise men, so it makes me think they came a few days after his birth. But I can't imagine Mary and Joseph staying in the stable for a minute longer than absolutely necessary. And she says, God bless you and Cyrus and all those who work at Relevant Radio, Mary. Thank you, Mary, so much. Appreciate that. And shout out to all of our listeners in England. Well, the best way I can answer that in a succinct manner would be to refer you to a book by Dwight Longenecker. Dwight Longenecker, L-O-N-G-E-N-E-C-K-E-R. He wrote a book called Mystery of the Magi, The Quest to Identify the Three Wise Men. So this is a really interesting book because it includes a lot of scholarship, maps. It's replete with all the biblical evidence that gets to the heart of the questions that you're asking. And here's a little blurb to give you something to go on. The evidence is clear and compelling. The mysterious magi from the East were in all likelihood astrologers and counselors from the court of Nabatean, king at Petra, that would be in modern-day Jordan, where the Hebrew messianic prophecies were well known. The star that inspired their journey was a particular planetary alignment confirmed by computer models that in the astrological lore of the time portended the birth of a Jewish king. The visitors whose arrival troubled Herod and all Jerusalem with him may not have been the turbaned Oriental kings of the Christmas Carol, but they were real. And by demonstrating that the wise men were no fairy tale, this book, Mystery of the Magi, demands a new level of respect for the historical claims of the Gospels. So that book is going to give you everything and more about the Magi. So check it out. We'll get a link to it for you on the show Twitter feed at P Madrid Show. I'll be right back right after this.